Start over. Do it with me." His eyes moved over to her like he'd just noticed that she was there. His lips were dark. This was a bad one. She counted as she breathed in, mouthing the numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, then switched to her fingers, 1, 2, 3, 4, and then murmured them aloud as she exhaled. The second time through, he tried to mirror her, but his breath was frantic, unsteady. She kept mirroring the breath for him the way Jellet had for her during her attacks. By the fifth time through, Kumpar was almost in sync. The rictus of tension in his face and shoulders was releasing a little. Just a little. Else appeared, her hair unkempt from the pillow. The others were all crowded behind Jessen and Kumpar like they were at a puppet show. She hated them all a little just then. All of them except Kumpar. "Are you here?" she asked. "Are you back now?" Kumpar's eyes found her. The little laugh that came out of him didn't have anything to do with humor.
Not entirely. "Jessen, did you know there's aliens?"
"Yeah, it's hard. I know.
They look like giant seafood and centipedes made out of knives, and they killed us and carried us off, and we're just acting like we're doing..."
"Yeah, we are.
Like nothing happened. Like this is normal."
"It isn't. Nothing is normal now."
Kumpar shook his head and whispered,
"I'm not all right. I'm not well."
Jessen took his hand, chancing that he was stable enough for the physical contact. He didn't pull away.
"You're not. You're pretty fucked up. We're all fucked up. Look at us. Tanner's tripling down on the research thing because it's something he understands. Sinia's completely shut down. Ricker's focused on all of us being mad at him so that he doesn't have to think about the rest of it."
She didn't say, "Else is drumming up bullshit sexual drama with Tanner and Daffod. Daffod is intellectualizing himself into a small steel cube. I'm pretty sure I'm suicidal." She'd made her point. "We're all broken. We're trying to find something we can control because we can't control anything," she said. He was weeping now. And shit, so was she. "None of us are okay. That's all right. We don't have to be. It's all right to be fucked up right now." The swarm is lying on its bed. The part of it that needs to sleep, sleeps, and is dreaming. The part of it that doesn't need sleep stretches its senses out. Because it occupies a body that is afraid, the swarm knows fear. It also knows hunger, and desire, and annoyance, and curiosity. None of these things are necessary to its original design and function, but they are all part of it now, as inextricable as cream poured in coffee. It knew that the others could be influenced by chemoreception. It can choose the simple aromatics that its skin produces and nudge the others to calm or panic, bonding or rage. It had not expected how much it is, in return, affected by them. The sour ache of Jessen's sweat, the shuddering panic of Kumpar's. The body it inhabits receives these chemical signals and reacts to them, dragging the swarm along with it. The swarm has considered disabling the host's pheromone receptor sites, blinding itself to the fears and stresses all around it. But the danger now is being noticed, and so it acts as the host body would act, feels what the host body would feel, participates in the subliminal conversation of primates whose subjective experience is a thin skin over an oceanic subconscious. It feels the slow magnetic pulse that among all the captives of Ajian, only it can feel. The pulse rises and falls away, and the swarm feels the information-rich stuttering within the field. It knows something about how the Karraks communicate within their world palaces. It senses compounds in the air, its chemoreceptors turned for a moment to something more sensitive than a bloodhound's nose, and it catalogues them. It has recorded every species that it passes on its way to and from the laboratory, every detail of the landscape outside the window in the common area, every variation in the wavelengths of light. It is the deepest record of the great enemy ever created. It knows more than armies have gleaned in centuries of war. The parts of it that dream, dream together. The host and the girl named Amir that preceded her now bleed into each other more easily when both are unconscious. The smell of cut weeds from the host's childhood summer fills the girl's recurring nightmare of missing an exam. The shopkeeper that the girl is trying to argue with is also, in the logic of dream, the host's first lover. The swarm is aware of all this, without participating in it. It has stopped all active probing. No radio or NIR pings. No echolocation mapping. Temptation erodes it, eats away at its resolve. There is so much it could discover, so much it could know, just there beyond the reach of its senses. To come this far, to achieve this much, and miss the one unforeseen fact that could end the war because it was too timid. But its discipline holds for now. Its mission is as simple as it is difficult. Find a way to share the data it has gathered and is gathering. Somewhere in the world city, there is a pathway for it. Somewhere in the Karrak security protocols, there is a flaw. Until it can find that pathway, it has to be indistinguishable from the others. They are traumatized, so it must be traumatized. They are in pain, and so it must be in pain. We're all broken. That was what Jessen had said. We're all broken. So it must be broken too. It has to find ways to explore more than the quarters and the laboratory, but in a way that won't draw attention. Not from the Karraks, not from the humans, not from anyone. It has to take whatever freedom it can, flow into whatever niches are possible for it, all without getting caught, without getting itself and the others killed. The magnetic pulse rises again, shuddering with information. An answering pulse comes from the north, and another from above. The network of ships or drones or organisms at the edge of the planet's atmosphere sing down to the world palace, their attention like a spotlight sweeping the darkness of a prison yard. The swarm keeps still. As if in response, the dream shifts. The host is naked on a vast plain of tall yellow grass. Animals move, troubling the wide blades. The host and the girl who is gone are both there. They both know that if they move, predators will find them. But if they don't move, they will never escape. The tension between these two facts is a kind of horror. And also an excitement, a thrill. The part of the swarm that needs to sleep dreams, and for a moment, the part that doesn't sleep dreams with it. Chapter 16. Tell me you've solved it all and the secrets of creation have laid themselves out before you, Kumpar said as he swept into the lab. I need good news this morning. We ran out of cream, and I had to drink my coffee black. Daffod shot a glance at Tonner. The lead researcher's smile was thin and bloodless, but it was a smile. He was amused. Or he was doing his best to be gentle, given Kumpar's recent breakdown. Either way, it was better than most of the previous 8 hours had given. Dafydd had worked in Tonner's lab for a little over a year, but he'd never worked this closely with the man himself, or for this many hours at a time. His focus and intensity were exhausting. His moods shifted with less warning than the weather, and 3 times in the past week, Dafydd had understood something new about biological systems so profound and unexpected that it had taken his breath away. Else came in just behind the big man. They all wore the same pale tunic and trousers, like they'd become monks in some obscure gallantist order, but Else's seemed to fit her better. Her hair was back in a simple ponytail. There were no cosmetics or beauty products to be had in their Carrick's prison. All of them had been scrubbed down to whatever genetics and fate had gifted them with. Even so, Dafydd found he had to make an effort not to stare at Else when she walked in. He hoped she was carefully not looking at him for the same reason. Tonner crossed his arms. The silicate pulp in the middle of the berries isn't a gut or a separate organism, he said. It's a farm. Kampar's light-hearted performance vanished. He hoisted himself up to sit on the countertop, his gaze turning inward. They'd all known that the berries were a thick, red complication of organs around a sandy and undifferentiated center. They'd spent the better part of a week debating the nature of the pulp. If it was a cytoplasmic analog and the berries were a large cell, the way an egg was. If it was a dependent mutualistic organism like mitochondria. Then, for reasons Dafydd didn't understand, Tonner had decided to test the thin, pink soup of the sacrificed samples for metabolic activity. When the berries were ground to pieces, their metabolism rose. Dafydd hadn't known what to make of it. Everyone else apparently did. Micro-organic farming, Kampar said. That's clever. So the shell organisms feed sugars into the sand. To little bastards in the silicate matrix who hand complex nutrients back up to keep the shell alive and functioning, Tonner said. That sandy crab isn't an organism. It's 100 different ones. Or 1,000. I don't know. It's an environment. And it's under management. Constraint. Else let out a low, appreciative whistle. That complicates things. Or it makes them simple, Tonner said. The organism is already a nutrient factory. If we find a good candidate species in the farm, maybe we don't have to worry about working out berry metabolism at all. Leave it as it is and focus on using the farm for ourselves. Or introduce something from outside that can benefit from it, Kampar said. A cuckoo. Depends on the farm's immune response, Else said, assuming it has one. That seems like an easy initial test, though. Dafydd crossed his arms. For the most part, he followed what they were saying. If not the full depth of implications, at least the gist. But the leaps of insight and understanding that were so automatic for them left him feeling stupid. All Tonner had to say was, "It's a farm," and the others were already halfway to making a protocol. While the three of them debated the merits of introducing a novel organism versus figuring out plasmid analogs for the berry's existing microbiota, Dafydd washed out the gel trays and ran the CCA's cleaning cycle. His jaw was uncomfortably tight. "Any sign of our jailer?" Tonner asked, changing the subject at last. Else answered, "No, the librarian didn't make an appearance today either. It did say to tell it what we needed, right? I didn't imagine that. Hard to do that when it doesn't show up." "They have strange blind spots," Kampar said. "They know we brush our teeth, but not that we clip our fingernails. They know we use utensils to eat, but what exactly they are seems to baffle them. It may have left us some way to make requests that we haven't fathomed." "Good point. We need to remember how little we understand about this place," Dafydd said. It didn't seem like the big man was in danger of losing it again, but Dafydd found himself wanting to be agreeable anyway. Kumpar was taller, heavier, and stronger than any of the rest of them. If he lost it and needed to be restrained, it would be a bad day for the entire group. Dafydd shot him a smile. Kumpar smiled back. Tanner made an impatient sound. I don't have time to figure out all of this and them, too. Dafydd, are you ready to go? I'll stay a little and finish cleaning up, was on the tip of his tongue. He could already see the ghost of a smile on Elsa's lips, her embarrassment that he'd been so obvious. Instead, he said, sure. As he passed her, Else touched his arm. Not a caress, not a clasp, just a tap of her fingertips against his forearm. The kind of gesture that didn't mean anything, unless it did. Are you all right? She asked. You look tired. Dafydd hated the way his heart leaped. I'm a little tired. I'll get some rest. He followed after Tanner before the man could look back and see anything. Not that Dafydd was sure what there was to see. Tanner marched out through the vast shared room with his head down, staring at the deck ahead of him and his hands and fists at his sides. He didn't look at the strange creatures around them, didn't acknowledge they were there except to step away from them. Dafydd couldn't tell if it was disgust or fear or the strategy Tanner used to keep from being overwhelmed by too much that was new and inexplicable. They were almost back to their quarters when Dafydd's gut went tight. When they slid the wide door open, Jessen and Irina would be there. Or if they weren't, Tanner would call them to come out. Dafydd would hear about the berries and the farm again. Ricker and Sinia wouldn't participate, but they'd listen and be impressed. That was fair. Tanner could be impressive. Hey, boss, Dafydd said. I need to walk around a little, work out some kinks. I'll catch up. Don't go back to the lab, Tanner said. They don't need the distraction. Wasn't planning to, Dafydd said, and it mostly wasn't a lie. Tanner grunted and returned his attention to the floor. Dafydd watched him go, then walked back toward the cathedral. He didn't have a plan or place in mind, but being anywhere that wasn't the lab or their rooms felt like an escape. He found a little outcropping in one of the walls that stretched between alcoves. It wasn't quite a bench, but it was close enough. He put his back against the wall, pulled up his legs, hugged his knees, and took a moment to stop doing anything. It was strange the way that life kept going. They had lost everything. Homes, lives, their place in the vastness of the universe, and Kumpar still made coffee every morning. Irina still sang in the shower loud enough that they could hear her doing it, and he, apparently, still mooned after Else Yanin. He didn't know if it was a sign of their strength or their weakness. He didn't know whether Ajian still existed or if the Karaks had taken what they wanted from it and burned the rest to ash. He didn't know what had happened to the other prisoners from the ship, from all the ships. What the Karaks wanted or intended, how they would be treated if they managed to solve the biochemical puzzle they'd been given, what shape the future could be. It wasn't just unknown. It was probably unknowable. And in that fog, the thing that shook him was still Else's smile. You're an idiot, Dafydd said to no one. Just a total idiot. The huge room filled with alien bodies didn't disagree. Dafydd rested his head against the wall. The cathedral rose above him, its high windows glowing with sunlight. A wide knot of dark filaments swirled slowly in the upper air, like the tentacles of a huge diaphanous jellyfish. He didn't know if it was alive, or a piece of Karak's technology, or something else, but there was a beauty to it, the tendrils flowing with the invisible currents of the air. When he'd been a child, Dafydd had been terrified of spiders. Even imagining one in its slow, eight-legged crawl would send a shiver down his spine. But always simmering under the fear, he'd felt angry. Angry at himself for being afraid. And then, one day, the anger was stronger than the fear, and he forced himself to pick a spider up and let it crawl on his hand. He lasted only a few seconds before he fled, screaming. But the next day, he lasted a little longer, and within a few weeks he was catching spiders in his bare hands. When he showed his mother his great triumph over fear, she just laughed and said most people who are scared of spiders don't force themselves to get over it, they just leave them alone. My little Dafydd just hates anything telling him what to do. She'd been right. All his life, Dafydd had felt an irrational need to pull left when everything was telling him to pull right. It was petulant and petty, a childish need to not be controlled, even by himself. It had gotten him into trouble more times than he remembered, but he also wasn't scared of spiders anymore. When he'd first seen the cathedral and the alcoves, the hallways and ramps, the endless parade of terrifying creatures moving about, it had been overwhelming. Everything screamed at him to run away and hide in his room, so he sat and forced himself to stare up at the nauseating heights, to look at the monsters moving past. And the more time he spent there, the less assaulting it felt. The space was vast, but no more so than a few sports stadiums jammed together. What at first seemed like 100 different species of creature, each more grotesque than the last, had turned out to be maybe 12 or 15. He'd seen more varieties of life in zoological parks, and nothing here was more hideous than a tapeworm or a sea cucumber. His mind spent a lot of time attempting to shield itself using an irrational fear of the unknown. But, like picking up that first spider, forcing himself to engage with the fear without looking away was the best inoculation he knew. A pair of large beasts, the size of horses but with bone-colored exoskeletons, ambled by, their joints making little green flashes like static. A dozen glowing globes flew past, clicking to themselves or each other. Across the wide, open expanse of the cathedral floor, one of the carracks skittered with its hind legs and plodded with the front, accompanied by four soft Lothark. This one looked different from the librarian. It had a lighter coloration, almost yellow, and one of its massive forearms was banded by white in three places, like scars or tattoos. Dafydd watched the aliens move past him, pretending they were fish in an aquarium, and he found it almost restful. None of them had emotional lives entangled with his. Strange as they were, there was also a kind of beauty in all the ways evolution had solved its problems through luck and environmental pressure. Half a dozen of the amber-eyed, monkey-like things that kept invading the laboratory bounded past, saw him, screeched, and ran away. Most of them he didn't have names for. The few he did, he'd been told. Rakhund, Soft Lothark, Sinon, Carex. The others he could come up with his own signifiers, click bubbles, feather monkeys, whatever else, but that didn't seem as satisfying to him. The Carex turned, and its soldiers followed. They seemed to be homing in on one of the crow ape things that Dafydd sometimes saw facing the walls in the hallways. Hallway crows. The crow only showed that it knew the Carex was approaching by turning its back. Over the murmur that filled the cathedral like a train station, Dafydd thought he could hear something harsh and staccato coming from the Carex. Not its usual bass birdsong, but a kind of ripping sound. The hallway crow flinched and made a similar noise in reply. Because that was the difference, wasn't it? The species that he knew by name had been able to speak. They were the ones that had the little black squares, the translators. Now that he thought to look, it was almost exclusively the Kariks and their guards that had translators. He thought that one of the big bone horses might have had one around its neck, but they were gone by now, and he wasn't sure. The hallway crow was screeching now, and trying to walk away from the Kariks. The four soft Lothark shifted into its path, blocking its retreat. If Dafydd had had one of the black squares, he might have been able to fathom what the hallway crow was upset about, or learn its name. Ask it what it knew, and how it understood the Kariks and their shared prison. The Kariks lifted its massive forelegs, its fighting arms. With a clearer view, Dafydd was almost certain the white bands were scars. The hallway crow dropped to the ground, screeching like an exhausted child, and a moment later the Kariks lowered its forelegs again. A pack of black things, like crabs the size of large dogs, scurried across the floor, their feet making a sound like dry rice being poured over stone. In the high air, dozens of the clicking orbs were rising, converging on the dark filaments that still wafted and spun. It was all strange, but some of it was also beautiful. The horror behind it was real. There wasn't a moment that Dafydd couldn't feel the fear and tension in his body if he just turned his mind to it. But there were some moments when there was also awe. The clicking orbs reached the massive jellyfish thing and started wrapping themselves in its black threads. Dafydd wished there was someone there to see it with him, to wonder with him what it all meant, to remember it with him later. Instead, it was just his, a private moment that couldn't be shared. The hallway crow, still splayed on the floor, screeched louder and started flailing its limbs. It looked like a toddler throwing a tantrum. The movements were almost the same. "At least you can talk to your librarian," Dafydd said. "You're ahead of me." "They have strange blind spots," Kumpar said in his memory, at the same time the librarian said, "You are all permitted access to this pathway, and also to the complex." It was almost synesthesia. Dafydd saw the two thoughts, and how they fit like pieces of a jigsaw puzzle, how together they made something new. He got to his feet before he could talk himself out of it. The hallway crow had worn itself out. The four soft Lothark stood around it, looking at each other like they were deciding whether to kill the thing on the floor or let it be. The scar-armed librarian stood back a couple steps, letting whatever was happening play out. Dafydd went to it. "Excuse me," he said. "Please forgive me, I'm very new." The pale Kariks shifted. Its feeding arms were as thick as a human's, and longer. Its fingers were spidery, and it didn't have thumbs. Its wide, flat eyes found him, but it didn't speak. "The librarian of my moiety said I was permitted here at the complex, and my quarters, and the path between them. Am I allowed to go other places?" The thing's fingers plucked at each other, and the Kariks whistled and burbled. The voice that came from the dark square around its neck was the one from Azian, the dispassionate conqueror's voice. "Permission in one place has no bearing on other places." "Thank you. So there are other places I am permitted to go?"
"There are places you are permitted, and places you are not."
A little flush of pleasure rose up Dafydd's chest. "We have made a mistake. I need help finding the way to the librarian of my moiety." The Kariks didn't answer. Not to him. It let out a flurry of hard clicks. The prone hallway crow replied in kind.
When the Carrix turned and walked away, the soft Lothark went after it. After a moment of uncertainty, Daffid followed too. The Carrix and its guards, or orderlies, or soldiers, moved quickly to the far side of the cathedral and through a wide archway to a passage that sloped down. The air felt thicker here, and it smelled like smoke from a chemical fire. Daffid coughed, but the Carrix didn't look back at him. If this goes badly, he thought, they will never find my corpse. He didn't know why that was funny, but it was. The passage dropped. Other archways opened into it, and he caught glimpses of other cathedral spaces, the gateways to other sets of alcoves, and other things, too. A place that looked like a vast web, spider silk too fine to see the strands, but so thick that the far walls were hidden. A pool of water as wide as a small lake, with disturbances on its surface where something was moving beneath. He wondered if any of the other captives of Agian were through those archways, in labs or workrooms of their own, facing tests that were all really the same test. Are we useful? Other aliens walked along with them or passed in the other direction. Some were Rakund and soft Lothark. Some were other things that he hadn't seen before. Most, if not all, had the black squares on them. After what felt like most of an hour, the Carrix left the passageway through a wide, low gate that the soft Lothark pulled open for it. Daffid followed into a maze of low halls with inward-tilted walls like the ones in the ship coming over. There was a sound here that his mind kept wanting to interpret as water flowing over stones. It wasn't that, though. It was the voices of Carrix, dozens of them, maybe, all speaking at the same time. One of the soft Lothark shifted in front of him, stopping him with its body as the scar-armed Carrix went on. To Daffid's left, an archway led to a ramp that curved down. He pointed to it. There? The prison guard didn't answer, but turned and walked away. Daffid squeezed his hands into fists and released them again, trying to relax. He walked down the ramp slowly, willing his senses a little farther around the curve of the wall than he could actually see. The ramp ended in a room as cramped as Daffid's first apartment, and the large-eyed Carrix was squatting in the middle of the space, manipulating a series of glowing, floating cubes with its thin forearms, its wide black eyes locked on to Daffid. Daffid cleared his throat and tried again. I'm Daffid Alcor, with the work group. You told us to make one thing food for the other one?
I know these things, the librarian said in its reedy voice.
You also said we should tell you if there was something else we needed in order to do our work. Where the fuck have you been? Tanner said as Daffid stepped back through the wide main door. Outside the windows, the sky had turned stormy and dark. Rain pattered against the glass, making the orange lights on the ziggurats shudder and run. Else and Kumpar were sitting at the table, and Daffid was flattered to see the worry and relief in their eyes. Jessen and Irina, he assumed, were back at the lab. He'd been gone more than 8 hours. He was hungry. He was exhausted. He was elated. He was spent. Daffid put down his little metal crate and closed the door behind him.
What's that? Else asked.
He lifted the top of the crate with a clank and pulled out a thick sheaf of pages that were something like paper, if not actual paper itself. Then, two pots with sticky, black, butter-textured ink, and a handful of metal styluses.
I got pens, he said.
Chapter 17. Jessen drew the blade down the berry's shell. Its blood, pink and fragrant, welled up and out as she pinned it back to expose the sandy interior. It was the 24th berry she'd skinned that morning. The others lay out in a grid on the countertop, each marked by a slip of Daffid's faux paper. They were waiting to see what kinds of amino acids, when introduced to the rich environment of the Pope, made the farm die faster. "No, no, no," Irina said from near the mouth of the alcove. "Thank you, no, we don't want anything." The feather monkeys had brought a small gray box into their alcove and deposited it on the floor. They screamed and chittered as Irina tossed it back out of their workspace and into the corridor beyond. One of the alien animals rose up, its arms open like it was going to hug Irina, but then it turned and loped out after the object, and the three others followed it.
"I think you hurt their feelings," Jessen said. "What if you just rejected a proposal of marriage?"
"They are cute, but dating outside your species is challenging," Irina replied. "How are you doing?"
"I'm fine," Jessen said.
It was what she always said. The truth was, it was hard to get out of her bed. It was hard to eat food. It was hard not to get lost in fantasies where oblivion was the closest thing the universe had to rest. She envied the others their energy. The Carrick's guards wouldn't answer questions about where the other groups from Ajian were, and the aliens that didn't have translators didn't say anything at all. So Sinia and Else had been going on walks together, mapping out the labyrinth of the complex and looking unsuccessfully so far for more humans. Ricker had gone on a couple longer explorations on his own, but he didn't talk about them much. He also used a pen and paper to draw little games that he and Sinia played, passing time together in their exile. Jessen would have liked to play a game, or take a walk, or at least have the energy to consider them. Every day was hard. Everything was hard. She had one pill left, and she should have taken it almost 2 weeks ago. She knew enough about the action of the medication to understand that, with the present levels in her bloodstream, it wouldn't make much difference. Some stubborn, irrational part of her brainstem insisted that as long as there was one left, as long as she wasn't out, there was hope. It was the part of her illness that Jellet had called bad magic, back when he'd been around to call it anything. Jessen shook her head like she could dislodge the thought. Thinking about Jellet was like pressing her thumb against a razor blade. It was easy to do too much, and she never knew how close she was to damage until she was already bleeding. She plucked up another berry and slit it open to get at what it tried to keep inside for itself, and thought about the phrase physical hypocrisy. "Ready for the samples?" Irina asked.
"Almost."
"Samples ready?"
"Almost."
"Professionals." Irina chuckled. "If we're lucky, these little puppies will have nice, broad toxicity tolerances. We still have to figure out what not turtles actually eat. The farm's not much good if we don't know what to plant in it."
"Yeah,"
Irina sighed. "It all needs to get done. Easy's fast, and hard takes all the time. But hey, maybe we can find a way to make some coffee creamer in the meantime. Get Kampar to quit." "Jessen, are you all right?"
"What?"
"Yes, no, I'm fine." But she wasn't. She was shaking. Nutrition. She'd been thinking about food, but food was just a set of chemicals the same as anything else. The thing that could mend her brain was 17 carbon atoms, a few chlorines and nitrogens, and the holes all filled with hydrogen. It wasn't exotic. It wasn't strange. She could have synthesized it herself if they'd had a different lab set up. They were making the berries into biochemical factories that could produce specific outputs, and one of the outputs could cut the rot out of her mind. Maybe. Maybe not, but maybe. Hope was like a breath of air when she'd already resigned herself to drowning. Hands trembling, she took another slip of paper and wrote her initials on it, then placed the berry she'd been vivisecting onto it. There were other compounds in the pill, the one precious pill she hadn't had the heart to swallow. If she introduced the medicine to the berry, and it died faster, she wouldn't know if it was the molecule she cared about or one of the others in the matrix that had been the poison. If it didn't, though, if nothing in the pill was immediately toxic to the berries, she wouldn't have to keep pretending that she wasn't marching toward her own death. The urge to live bloomed up just below her throat, warm and desperate and bright. "I have to run back to the rooms for a minute," she said as she put down the knife. "Now? Just for a minute. I need to get something." Irina shrugged. "Should I finish those up?" "No," Jessen said, and then, "Actually, yes. Just the control group. I'm sorry." "It's fine," Irina said. "Go." Her body felt like she'd taken a euphoric, bright and light and electric in a way she relished and knew better than to trust. She walked along the well-known path between the lab and the rooms as if she was seeing it for the first time. The wide central space with its dozens of alcoves like the one she spent her time in. The strange bodies, monstrous and beautiful and both, that moved through the space with her, as thick as a downtown street during festival. The green bronze walls and floors, the same as the ships that had killed Agian. She hauled the wide door open when she reached it. The rooms were sun-soaked and empty, except for Tanner standing at the kitchen counter with pages of handwritten notes spread out before him. When he glanced up, he looked annoyed. "You're supposed to be at the lab." "I'm going right back. We have a schedule." "I'm not stopping at the bar on my way back," she snapped, then went to her room before he could reply. The pill bottle was under her bed, the same place she'd hidden away her most precious things when she'd been a child. The one pill in it was a dull, dusty orange with a manufacturer's mark pressed into it. The pharmacological labs that had made it were under a different sun, if they still existed at all. Even if this worked, she'd be medicating herself with excretions from the sandy pulp of an alien animal. "Please, let this work," she whispered, though she wasn't one of the pious. "Please, let this work. Please." When the universe didn't answer, she wrapped the bottle in her fist and left. Cynia was singing in her room, a slow, strange song that Jessen didn't recognize. If the experiment worked, she should probably plan to make an extra dose for the older woman. For that matter, they should probably just put it in the water supply. She could make vanilla and cinnamon along with the creamer. She could do anything. That wasn't true. It was the euphoria talking. The hope. Tanner didn't look up again or speak as she left. The wide door closed on him. In the passageway, one of the Carricks lumbered past on its massive front arms, its abdomen scuttling along behind it. Its voice was fluting and deep, a study in undertones. It was almost beautiful. She felt a surge of hatred for it. How dare it be beautiful? She had nearly reached the alcove when the sound of the explosion came. Not the sharp crack of detonation, but a low, rumbling whoosh, the crackling of a sudden, vast fire. All around her, the aliens paused, shifted. Some ran, but not in any particular direction. No alarm sounded, but an acrid smell like burning plastic seeped into the air. A distant chorus of high, angry voices screamed in pain, or else victory. She walked forward until she turned the last corner before their lab. Then she ran. A thin smoke clung to the ceiling outside their alcove. The flame was either out or invisible, and whatever had happened, it had damaged the lights. They flickered, blindingly bright to utter black like a strobe, without the rhythm. And caught in the flashes, like still images from a violent book, the feather-haired monkeys were running riot. One, with particularly long arms and needle-sharp teeth, stood on the countertop, smashing the berries she'd spent the morning prepping into a single, wide pink smear. Another was ripping the pages of notes in its tiny, clever hands. Two others were standing on a bundle of something on the ground, hunched over it with their shoulders tense, biting it, worrying it like dogs taking apart a stuffed toy. The terrible thing wasn't the violence. It was the joy. The bundle moved, and Jessen recognized Irina. She moved without thinking, like the world had suddenly shifted, and she wasn't running toward the lab, but falling. She heard herself shouting, "No, no, fuck off!" She grabbed one of the attackers off Irina's back. It was the weight and texture of a large house cat. It squirmed in her grip, thrashed, clawed, bit. Jessen clubbed the corner of the countertop with it. Three hard blows before the monkey went limp, then two more afterward. Something clamped onto her leg, sharp and grinding. One of the other beasts had sunk its teeth into her. The long-armed one that had been ruining the samples rose up on the countertop. It had claws like little daggers. The pain of the bite was fierce, and something unexpected in Jessen welcomed it. "Yeah? You gonna kill me?" Jessen shouted, lunging for it. It danced back. "You gonna kill me, you little fuck? Come here and try!" Something landed on her back. Teeth sank into her shoulder, and some strange part of her mind became very calm. Yes, it hurt. Yes, she wanted it off. But the pain was just data. Her attacker was just a problem, and you fixed problems the same way, a step at a time. And more than that, the pain was permission. She reached down to her leg where the one enemy was still attached and wrapped her hand around its neck. She could feel the moment it realized it was in trouble and tried to pull away. The other on her shoulder let go, shrieked, and started clawing at her eyes. But she ignored it, bringing her other hand down and cracking the one monkey's neck. The tension and sudden release felt just like breaking a bone. It spasmed in her hand as it died, and she thought how interesting it was that there was some parallel evolution of spinal cords. Lucky you aren't being eaten by something with a more distributed nervous system like octopuses, starfish. She reached up for the one on her shoulder, but it bounded away. The two remaining attackers scuttled out of the alcove and bounced excitedly in the cathedral. Their gums were black. They screamed. On the floor by Jessen's feet, Irina coughed and tried to sit up. "Bomb," the other woman said. "That thing they brought before, it was a bomb. I didn't throw it out. I was... the samples. Don't talk. Don't try to talk. It's going to be all right. You're going to be fine." She didn't look fine. Blisters were rising on the pale skin of her face. The ends of her white blonde hair were now black and twisted where they'd burned. A small but spreading pool of blood smeared the floor under them. And at first, Jessen thought it was coming from Irina. Hey, call the guards, Jessen shouted. We're hurt, we've been attacked. In the cathedral, the alien menagerie went back about its business. One of the raccoon slid by, its legs undulating as it hurried past. The long-armed monkey chittered, made eye contact with Jessen, and shat on the ground before the two surviving attackers turned away, vanishing into the crowd. "Please, someone, we're hurt. We're both hurt." Then a moment later, "What the fuck is wrong with you assholes?" "Emergency medical, not so great here," Irina managed. Then her breath caught in pain. Yeah, Jessen said, past the panic in her throat. You'd think with all the shit they built, these fucking roaches could manage an ambulance. Irina smiled, but her gaze shifted, losing focus. No, 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 Jessen said. Stay here. Stay with me. Go back. Get the others. If I leave you and they come back, they'll kill you. The work, though. If no one's here, the work's gone. The alcove's light flickered again, this time with a deep red and a sound like water on a hot skillet. When it went out, it didn't come back. We have to go back to the room. We have to go together. I just, Irina began, and didn't finish. Jessen's back and side were cold. The adrenaline had faded enough to let the pain in her shoulder and leg burn through. The walk back to the room seemed terribly long, even without a burden, and Irina would die if she left her. Jessen might not understand anything else in this hellscape, but she was sure about that. She shifted her weight, moved to Irina's side. There was a way to do this. She'd learned it in some rescue aid camp when she'd been a child. She remembered trying it on Jellet and being so proud that she could pick him up. How had it worked? With only the light spilling into the alcove from the outside, she drew Irina up to sitting, then leaning her against the counter to a somnolent stand. This was right. Old memory came through, and Jessen bent, drew the semi-conscious woman across her own torn and bleeding shoulder. Holding Irina's leg with one hand and her arm with the other, Jessen lifted. I can't do this, she thought, her thighs and back burning with the strain. But she took a step forward anyway, and then another. Her breath seemed unnatural, too close and also somehow not associated with her, like listening to someone else laboring beside her. She spat, took another step, then another, and she was walking. Around them, the surreal traffic of alien bodies flowed like images from nightmare. Nothing offered her aid, but nothing stopped her either. They were all in the same corridor. They were all in different worlds. By the halfway point, she was muttering, I can't go on, with each step, and then taking another after it. I can't go on. I can't go on. I can't go on. When she reached the wide door, she couldn't remember how she'd gotten there, or how long she'd been standing, looking at it bemused. She couldn't open it, and she couldn't figure out how to knock. The best she could manage was to go up to it and bang her forehead against it, again and again and again, until it opened and Else looked out at her with wide, startled eyes and her mouth agape. Hey, Jessen said, and sank to the ground. Irina rolled gently off her shoulders, their clothes making a wet ripping as they parted. The dried blood had glued them together. In what seemed like a blink, everyone was there. Kampar lifted both women, one in each arm, like they were light as a feather, and carried them to the couch. Sinia showed up with a cloth and a bowl of warm water, wiping away the worst of the gore and finding the gouges in her flesh when she flinched. Tonner ran out to see the lab. Jessen thought she'd told them about the attack, about the bomb and the feather-haired murderers, but she wasn't sure. She tried again now, but Else put a hand on her shoulder and pressed her back into the bed. Oh, somehow she was in her bed. Did Irina? Jessen said. Else's mouth tightened, and for a moment she looked angry. Only no, it wasn't anger, or sorrow. Horror. Else was horrified. Jessen tried again. Is she? I'm sorry, Else said. I'm so sorry. Chapter 18. We can't work if we're not safe. You understand that? They killed her. They killed my researcher. She's dead. Tonner paced because he couldn't stand still. The librarian seemed to watch him. But who could be sure with these things? Its mind could have been on lunch for all Tonner knew. It sure as hell wasn't expressing contrition or remorse or any of the things that ought to have been coming out of it. It was like talking to a wall. David stood still at the side, impassive as a referee. Tonner had made the man take him to the librarian's office, or den, or lair, or whatever the right word would be. Rage had carried him there. The librarian burbled and hummed, and the square at its throat spoke. "That is an interesting issue." "What? What's an interesting issue?" "That you cannot work without safety." Tonner barked out a laugh. "They killed Irina. Those fucking little monkey things put a bomb in our lab. How do you expect us to do your project?" "That is also interesting," it said. Tonner pressed his hands to his mouth. His head felt like it was filled with bees. He told himself it was anger, but it seemed like more. "We did what you wanted," he said. "We did what you said."
"Your project is completed?"
"No, I mean, we're trying. We were making progress, and they..." The words ran out. Irina's corpse, the ruins of his lab, Jessen and Kampar and Sinia crying. It was all inside him, and the power of it should have been enough to change something. But he couldn't get it out. He thought he'd say it, and it would get out of him. But it wasn't saying that mattered. It was being heard, and the librarian wasn't listening. "We do what you say, and you keep us safe. That's the deal."
"That is not accurate."
David took half a step forward. "Excuse me, I don't mean to intrude, but may I ask something?" "Fine," Tonner snapped. David turned toward the librarian. "The things that attacked us, is there something we can call them?" The librarian's abdomen shuffled from side to side on its four smaller legs.
"They refer to themselves as night drinkers."
"And are the night drinkers working on the same test we are?"
"There is only one test."
"Thank you for this important reminder. Are these night drinkers trying to turn the berries into food for the Knot Turtle too?"
"They are."
"And if we can do it faster, we are more useful to the Carricks," David said. This time it wasn't a question.
"Thank you. We understand better now."
"But you are unable to work without safety." "Damn right," Tonner said, but David put his palm out, holding his hand low, almost at his waist. "We will adjust to these clarified conditions," David said to the monster, his tone making everything that had happened their own fault. It galled. Tonner wanted to slap him across the head for not even trying to negotiate. The librarian paused for a moment, as if considering what David had said. Then,
"The body will be removed."
David's head came up like he'd heard something that Tonner hadn't. "Thank you," he said, then gestured to Tonner and walked away. Tonner hesitated, then followed. They walked up the long winding ramp without speaking. The only sound was the low, rumbling babble of Carrick's voices and a single high shriek whose meaning Tonner couldn't guess. The endless hallways intersected, branched, turned. David walked like he knew the way, and Tonner resented him for it. "What the fuck was that, Alcor?"
"I don't think we should tell it we can't do the work."
"You don't make that decision. You aren't the one in charge of this group. That's me. I am."
"All right. I'm sorry."
Tonner muttered an obscenity that was only half directed at David. His arms were trembling. He felt unsteady. The feeling in his head that wasn't anger had gotten stronger, but he didn't want to think about it. He was sweating and cold at the same time. He didn't like that. They reached the wide corridor with its traffic of guard species. The air smelled like vinegar. Tonner put his head down, staring at the floor just in front of his feet. It was the only way he could walk without his brain getting overloaded. Every alien thing that caught his attention was like looking into the sun. His mind grabbed at them all, tried to make them into something he knew, something that made sense. After a while, it felt like a migraine without the pain. Just looking at them was exhausting, so he didn't look. As long as he kept control of his focus, he was fine. Not that they made it easy for him. He fell into a rhythm, one foot in front of the other. He could pay attention to that, counting his steps from 1 up to 10 and then back down again. Now and then he had to shift to the right or left to make way for one of the guards or one of the Carricks. He tried not to let it throw off his concentration. He tried to keep his mind quiet. His mind wouldn't stay quiet. Irina was dead. Her corpse was in her room, on her bed. She'd been complaining that they were out of apples. She'd just been complaining that they were out of apples, and now... Oh, Daffod said, like he just remembered something. What? Tonner snapped, grabbing at the sound and his annoyance and anything that wasn't Irina's sweet face charred to black. It knew we didn't have a way to take care of the body, Daffod said. Something was bothering me, that was it. It knew that our species doesn't eat its dead or whatever. It knew to send someone. They didn't know we liked writing things down, but they knew that. That's very interesting. I'm so very interested, Tonner said with a harshness that meant he didn't care. If Daffod picked up on that, he ignored it. I don't think Irina is the first one of us who's died in this complex. If you've got nothing helpful, don't talk. Back at the quarters, Else, Cynia, and Kampar were sitting at the window. Storm clouds below them flashed with lightning, but no thunder came. High in the twilight gray of the sky, 5 bright pink lights glowed. Tonner wanted them to be transport drives, but they weren't. He didn't know what they were, or if he'd be able to understand them, if he knew, but the familiar things were all gone now. The framework that he'd lived in didn't apply, but he didn't have another one, so he let his brain call them transport drives and ignored the tension of being wrong. All 3 turned to look at him while Daffod hauled the wide door closed. The complexity of anticipation and grief and fear was overwhelming. Tonner's scowl ached. It didn't care, he said, and then stalked to the little kitchen so that he wouldn't have to see them react. It said it would send some kind of cleanup crew to help with her body. That's the help we get. He waited for Kampar to say something arch, but no one said anything. He went through the little pantry without any idea what he was looking for. The fresh fruits were gone, but there were some preserves. Dehydrated and salted and packed in skins of removable gel.